Yeah, that was really fun. Thank
yeah,
you
sorry if it was too apocalyptic at the end.
No, that's great. That's what we used to sell the episode.
All right, good.
Hey, I'm Asad Serpet.
I'm Jeremiah Budin, and you're listening to The Appeal, a podcast from The Current.
Today, we have Jeff Mena in the studio with us. He's a design and tech writer and the author of the new book, A Burglar's Guide to the City.
We're going to be talking to him all about that book and about how burglary and architecture intersect and burglars use architecture to break into buildings. And it's really interesting, so stick around.
So yeah, thanks again for coming in. It's really exciting to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We figured we'd start with a question we've been asking a few of our guests. When you're at a cocktail party, how do you describe what you do?
Well, I guess I usually just say I'm a writer. If they ask a little bit more, I'll say I'm an architecture and design writer. And then if they want to know if that's just a typical kind of New York City thing that people claim to be at cocktail parties, then I might mention the burglary book. So that usually changes the direction of the conversation quite dramatically.
Now you have proof that you're a real writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have a little photograph I carry in my wallet, right. So they can see the cover.
When you say that the typical thing people say at parties is architecture and design writer, like a typical thing people say yeah. at parties?
No, I just mean the claim to be a writer living in New York thing is pretty... Anyone with access to paper can claim to be a writer in New York City. So it's quite a lot of people.
You don't even need paper these days.
That's true.
Yeah, it depends what you what you say at a cocktail party might be slightly different from what you put on your taxes.
Yeah,
I'm thinking about taxes right now because I still haven't done them.
Oh no,
but we don't. Yeah, we don't need to talk about that.
Yeah, you're late, but we don't.
Yeah,
have
don't
to
let the don't let the IRS listen to this podcast then.
Well, I got some time.
Okay,
but taxes. All right, you have this book coming out, The Burglar's Guide to the City.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you interested in the first place in taking on the subject?
I guess I'd say a whole bunch of things. You know, it always struck me as someone who wrote about architecture that some of the more interesting aspects of how people deal with the built environment were actually coming out of the world of crime. So, you know, it's everything from if you watch a heist movie or if you read a police report or, you know, I set up a Google alert for heists and burglaries and that kind of thing. And so every morning I'd wake up and I'd read the news, and then it seemed really interesting that, you know, if there had been a burglary the night before or that week, there'd always be video of, you know, really baffled business owners talking to TV crews at 7 a.m. in the morning or talking to the police, you know, going through all the details about how somebody, you know, they tunneled in and they went through this wall and then that wall and then they went out through a door and or they revealed something up in the roof that they didn't even know was up there. And it just seemed to me that burglary was a really interesting way to reveal something about how buildings worked. And it was also, it's a crime that cannot occur without architecture. So it's not a book about theft, for example. People ask me a lot, you know, about sleight of hand magicians or that kind of thing. And it's not that kind of book at all. So you can actually be a burglar without stealing anything. So it's specifically a crime that involves entering an architectural space. Mm. And so in that regard, I thought it'd just be a really interesting architectural take on a crime.
Right. Did it make you terribly paranoid getting all those Google alerts every morning? Like, I cannot imagine being able to function at the same level before I'd gotten those Google alerts set up. It's crazy.
I mean, there were definitely things that it made me think twice about as far as things I do, like even little dumb things, like I no longer put the service please tag out on a hotel door handle if I'm staying in a hotel. If need be, I'll call down and say, I just left my room. Like, you know, you can do it, but you don't want to signal to everybody in the hotel that somebody's not in there.
Right.
But no, actually, I guess it didn't make me too paranoid. I mean, it made me a little bit more security conscious, but I guess I didn't go into this thinking, you know, I'm not like a basket case now, you know, hiding in my apartment.
And, good. We're glad to hear that.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned, I think at one point, that the rates of burglary are down significantly, right?
Is that true? Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Is that so? Why is that?
I think it's
out of fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bunch of things. I mean, it's down. I mean, you know, criminologically, it's down because just other types of crime have taken its place. So, you know, it's much easier to just put a skimmer on an ATM or to get, you know, while you're filling out your tax forms, I can get your social security number
please don't.
I'll try not to.
And is this because of the advent of all of the, you know, digital ways that people are filing their taxes and, you know, people are using ATMs at a greater rate than they were?
Yeah. And so things before, like identity theft. And I mean, sometimes is analog, you know, if I steal your mail, I can get a whole bunch bunch of information about you just from the stuff that I take out of your mailbox. But so with digital crime on the rise, and it's so easy just to, you know, literally just skim money out of people's accounts, that the actual kind of hands-on approach of burglary is sort of, you know, out of fashion, right, as it were.
It's almost like an old-timey crime, like churning your own butter or something.
it's artisanal.
Like actually breaking into a building with your hands.
Yes, artisanal crime. Yeah. I like that.
You can hire a burglary crew to design a bespoke criminal acts for you in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So this is actually great news for people with fear of home invasions.
That's true. Yeah. And also, I mean, from the from the flip side, you can sleep well at night. But from the flip side too, you know, homeowners are just more tuned to the risks, and so people just are that much more paying attention to things that would be obvious red flags for a burglar, like leaving your window open if you have a fire escape that's accessible from the street, and putting your laptop in front of the window and then going to work for 8 hours. Like, stuff like that is just commonsensically stupid, so you don't want to do that. But in fact, I was literally just looking at the statistics this morning. And crime in New York City since 1990 has gone down 80, or excuse me, burglary in New York City has now gone down 87.3%, which is really, really astonishing. There were 122,000 burglaries in the year 1990 in New York City.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's outrageous, actually.
It's interesting that you mentioned putting your laptop in front of your window and then going to work, because I think one of the iconic images of New York life in media is like Carrie Bradshaw with her laptop in front of her West Village apartment, or I guess it's Upper East Side on the show, but that image is a thing that I remember talking to people who were moving to New York, like, can't wait to set up my personal office with my laptop in front of the window. But it's like, maybe that's not the smartest thing to do.
Yeah. Did she ever get burgled on that show?
That's a great question. I don't think so. We can find out.
Yeah, or we could try to reboot the series. Turn it into a crime drama.
A Netflix special where she just keeps getting burgled because of her terrible habits.
Yeah, Netflix would pick that up. Yeah. Sounds like a lot of intrigue in that show.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are tons of, obviously, heist movies where people break into things, because it's like pretty much like the most exciting crime almost, right? It's like such a, and it's like a fun, like if it goes right, nobody gets hurt. Everybody, they're stealing from like big banks, which, is like, you know, you don't feel that bad about it. Is it like, do you like sort of romanticize the act of burglary at all, do you think?
Well, I definitely think that's part of it. I mean, I think that it's hard to be attracted to the subject matter and not be, you know, swayed by that really swaggering sort of old-timey vision of these super heist planners who know everything about the city and time everything perfectly and can show up in a bank vault as if by magic. I mean, there is something really folkloristic and exciting about that. But I definitely don't think that the book tries to romanticize the figure of the burglar. But I do think that, I mean, Hollywood is doing that for us, you know, by presenting it this way. Whereas actually, like the overwhelming majority of burglary crimes usually involves drugs. It involves sort of a spur of the moment, non-planned events, and it's just people breaking in really quickly to steal something and then sell it for $5. So, I mean, that's the reality of burglary. But then the big heists that do come along, and, you know, they do happen every once in a while. There's one in the book that I'm kind of obsessed with, which is an unsolved crime from the 1980s in Los Angeles, where these a crew tunneled into a bank vault near the Sunset Strip, and it's never been solved. And it was a technically ingenious act. Even the FBI guys and the LAPD admired the technical skill of these guys and with their use of like the concrete coring machine and that kind of thing. And then I don't know if you were paying attention to the news from the burglary world last year, but there was a big heist in London in Hatton Garden, and that would have been the largest burglary in English legal history, but the guys ended up all being caught, and but that's another thing.
That was the group of like older gentlemen, right?
Yeah,
that was so cool.
When you say older gentlemen, how much older are we talking about?
Jeff, do you know?
The average age, I believe, was 64.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, it was basically retirees kind of on one final one big soiree. Yeah.
One last big score.
Yeah.
Or one first big score. Were they career criminals, or were they just like, we're going
to
do this?
I'd have to read again about exactly what their all their backgrounds were, but I'm certain that at least some of them were had criminal backgrounds. Yeah.
So what I found really interesting was the way the book opens with kind of the story of the 19th century figure, George Leonidas Leslie, and just that whole tale. Can you explain for listeners who probably don't know yet what his deal was and just kind of who he was as a person?
Sure. Yeah. So that's a really interesting story. So George Leonidas Leslie was trained as an architect. He was from Cincinnati. He graduated with honors. He was from a very privileged family. In fact, his dad, this isn't in the book, but his dad actually basically bought his way out of the Civil War so that his son didn't have to fight. Mm. And he moved to New York City. It was a time of incredible contrast in New York. You know, there's the Civil War had only just ended a few years earlier. There's broken families. But at the same time, there's an incredible wealth being accumulated and all these big mansions, many of which have now been torn down, but turning, you know, Manhattan into this almost like a big castle. But instead of becoming an architect and trying to make the city more beautiful or try to work with people that couldn't normally afford an architect, he decided that he could use his architectural training to just become the biggest burglar of his era. And so he actually was part of a crew that at one point was estimated to be behind 80% of all bank crime in the United States at the time, which is really, really astonishing.
And he didn't just, you know, according to the book, what you've written, you know, he didn't just work in New York City. Like, they got around Northampton, yeah. Massachusetts. I mean, you know, how many places kind of across the country do you know that he worked?
It was pretty much mid-Atlantic and New England mm-hmm. hit. So yeah, like Massachusetts and Maine and around New York City and then in Philadelphia as well. So he definitely had a pretty broad reach. It was really, I mean, the way he worked was really exciting and like architecturally interesting is what I mean, because he actually, you could argue that he's one of the people that kind of kicked off that notion of like the duplicate vault. You know, you see it mm-hmm. in Ocean's 11 where they build the fake vault to practice on, or even where they lay out the, you know, like the lasers that they then have to get through in that movie with Sean Connery and Michael Douglas.
Yeah, what is that movie called?
I don't know that one.
Entrapment.
Our producer, Harry. Yeah, right. We just simultaneously remember.
Yes, the voice of God gave us the answer. But yeah.
He would use, he would build decoy versions of the, or not decoy, he would build surrogate versions of these vaults that he was going to attack in warehouses over in Brooklyn that were run by a fence colleague of his. And then they would practice things even in the dark, and he'd have stopwatches. So his approach to burglary was very meticulous and very architectural. I think that's it makes him kind of emblematic of my interest in that crime, because, you know, it is this architectural crime, and it's a way of using buildings, and it's a way of revealing that even the room we're in right now is connected to other rooms through means other than the doors that the architects placed. And, you know, we could find a way to maneuver through mm-hmm. this skyscraper without ever using the things that were laid out for us by the architect. And that's the kind of the weird, almost like psychedelic mystery of burglary.
Right. I really enjoyed the theme of burglary being almost, cannot say that word, burglary being related almost to like this extreme love of architecture. Like, they know mm-hmm. they know the buildings better than almost anyone.
Yeah.
What was that? The other guy with the fire escapes. I love that one.
Oh yeah, Jack Daxman.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was really interesting as well. He was he got in touch with me and walked me through his method of targeting buildings, and that was really, really interesting as well. He actually now claims to work in the security field, so he spoke under a pseudonym, but he walked me through all the ways that he had studied basically the Toronto's fire code and used that as a way to kind of reverse engineer what the inside of a building must look like based on where fire exits were on the outside, where fire escapes might be, what buildings of that age and size would be required to have based on fire regulations. And then he could have a pretty accurate understanding of the inside of a building before ever setting foot in it. So that kind of x-ray vision of the city, I think, is something that is pretty mind-boggling. And also, you know, even the most overcommitted architecture student is not going to be able to tell you everything about the city's fire code and tell you, you know, how buildings are laid out inside. And so, yeah, that level of awareness, that kind of granular intelligence about the city that a burglar mm-hmm. would have, and also the strategic investment they have in knowing that so that they don't get caught, means that they often will know, or at least a figure like Jack Daxman will know a city much better than, you know, the people that we think know the city, like whether it's the mayor or an urban planner or some architectural historian. So mm-hmm. I think that aspect of it is really cool too.
Yeah. Maybe it's because of the prevalence of heist films in American cinema culture and how testosterone fueled those movies are. But you don't really think about the fact that there were also women who participated in kind of architectural crime. And there's a 19th century woman that is someone who worked with Leslie, who I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, because I found her kind of a fascinating figure.
Sure. Yeah. There's a woman whose nickname was Marm, and it was Marm Mandelbaum. And she was a fence who worked in New York City at the time. And, she was actually, you know, had her own architectural proclivities, I guess you could say, so that she had a kind of, a working den for her group off of, it was Rivington Street, actually, down in the east, Lower East Side. And even there, she had the, you know, the example I use in the book, you know, was that she actually had a fake flue inside a chimney so that when people came to raid her house or ask her questions, or for that matter, just sort of say hello, she could hide stolen goods by just pulling the flue, and a little dumb waiter inside the chimney would then disappear upwards and hide whatever she wanted to not be seen. And there was it wasn't really a secret entrance, but there was a disguised entrance through a pub around the corner, and all the different ways to get into her goods yard. So she was, and then she's the person who actually owned the warehouses that Leslie used to train in. So she definitely was a key part of making sure that his crimes were even possible.
Great. And we're in the last couple days of International Women's History Month. So yeah, glad to know about her.
I think Catwoman also, right, is a burglar.
Yeah. So that's my next book.
She deserves a mention. Yeah.
There was actually a case that this isn't in the book, but I blogged about this a number of years ago, but it was a gang of female burglars in somewhere in South America. I'm blanking on where it was exactly, but they would raid high rises, and some of them were pregnant at the time, but it was a core of these sort of hardcore female cat burglars, and they would use ropes and balconies and scale up into people's apartments and rob them. And that's a pretty interesting case of the female side.
I mean, I hope that there are some producers, some movie makers listening, because that's amazing. That's crazy.
And I feel like any one of these stories could easily be a good
exactly.
movie.
Exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of movies, do you have a favorite heist movie, or do you enjoy them, or is it sort of like a silly kind of like representation of this thing?
I mean, it's definitely, sometimes it can be really silly, but no, I pretty unironically enjoy heist movies. Mm-hmm. I think they're really exciting. I guess I don't have a favorite, but I mean, I love the movie Die Hard. I think it's a great portrayal of just how people can use architecture in unexpected and strange, you know, adrenaline fueled ways. Other movies that are just kind of like charming and fun to watch, like Thomas Crown Affair. And I'm not a huge fan of the Ocean's 11 series, but the Italian Job remake I think is pretty fun to watch. And yeah. and there's actually a movie, I'm hesitant to recommend it too strongly, but because it's it can not necessarily live up on the quality front, but there is actually a relatively accurate portrayal of burglary in terms of how it's undertaken and committed, but it's one of those Blair Witch Project style fake documentaries. Mm. But it's a movie called Street Thief, and it's about a guy in Chicago, and it follows him around. It purports to be two documentary film students who are following a burglar who lets them sort of see what it's like. It's obviously a fictional movie, but it is actually a pretty accurate portrayal of just sort of the kinds of things they go through, the kinds of tools you can use to get into buildings. And then when he raids a cinema at the end, it's a pretty great scene, actually. Mm. So that's a good one. And no one's ever heard of that movie, as far as I can tell.
Does he banter during it?
Banter?
That's like the one thing, whenever I watch a heist movie, they're always bantering. And I'm like, come on, guys, you would not actually be bantering this much while you're breaking into the, making these little quips.
I think he refrains from making Schwarzeneggerian one-liners, but he does at least a couple times have good lines.
Yeah. So one thing I've been just thinking about is just the flip side of this. I mean, you write about this in the book, but safe rooms and people just protecting themselves against the threat of burglary. Can you talk a bit about what those conversations were like? Because I imagine they were intense.
That was actually one of the more interesting parts of the research process, definitely. But so fundamentally, you know, if you're writing about burglary tools and you're trying to figure out how do burglars get into a vault, or how do they get it through a door, or how do they dismantle architecture for their own needs, and you start looking into those tools, the one thing that becomes immediately obvious is that actually there are specific tools designed and built for the purpose of getting into architecture extremely quickly, but they tend to be associated with demolition or law enforcement. And so when you actually look into law enforcement door breaching technology, you find this like unholy world of giant sledgehammers, my favorite of which is called the Ding Dong, and these backpack-sized door breaching units that actually have thermal lances, which are these crazy burning bars that can actually melt through granite. They were actually originally a demolition tool in I believe it was World War I, but for dismantling old bunkers and tanks and that kind of thing. But so in any case, you can take those tools and use them to get into buildings quickly. And so what that means, though, is that some of the best quote-unquote burglars in the world are actually federal agents and people with the ATF or the FBI, or for that matter the CIA. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about that side of the law as well, and how you can access architecture extremely quickly, doing what's known as tactical entry. And so that led to a whole bunch of really interesting things. But then as well, if you want to resist even these super tools, then you need an even stronger level of fortification. Mm-hmm. And that's where this like crazy structure at the end of time emerges. And that's this thing, the panic room. And so what I loved about the guy who I met in particular, even though there are obviously many panic room designers and he didn't invent the panic room, but he's a very, very interesting practitioner of what it means to design these structures.
And his name is Ken?
Carl Alvazad.
Carl Alvazad.
And,
okay.
He's a former, he's a retired New Jersey state cop who went into safe and vault design and actually traveled around the world. He was lived in the Netherlands and South Africa and Australia, England, et cetera. And he met both criminals and vault designers. And he kind of became this one man, you know, vault aficionado. But then he started designing these insane structures. And so to give you a sense of how strong these things are, using a like this proprietary concrete mix, as well as all of these fine grained metal shards that are inside the concrete, and it's all bolted together. He tests these things against old Russian military equipment.
Oh my goodness.
And so he actually flies the panels to an air base in Russia, and you can watch videos of this on his website. And they fire like 50 caliber sniper rifles that can't penetrate the stuff. They fire RPGs, you know, rocket propelled grenades at these things, and it can't penetrate this stuff. And then also C4 shape explosives. So that's like what you would use to take down a sports stadium if you're going to build a new one. So, you know, you ring the stadium with C4 and then you blow it up. But even C4 didn't take this stuff down. And so, yeah, I joke in the book that, you know, this guy has inadvertently created an architecture that's going to outlast the pyramids. You know, they're going to be these, you know, like the homes of dead pharmaceutical CEOs in rural New Jersey that have collapsed into the dust of time. But then they're going to be these little safe rooms in the core of it all, just sort of outlasting human civilization.
Do you know how many people have these things? Is it like a widespread?
It's not very widespread, yeah, but at the same time, it's impossible to get a client list, obviously,
right?
Because, you know, it's like Fight Club. You know, the you know, if the minute you mention or you admit to having a safe room, you become a target, and it also kind of invalidates the purpose of having it. So people just make sure that they can break in quick enough that you can't get into the safe room. But you do see that they are trying to get the industry a little bit more widespread. So trying to get the price point down so that, you know, anyone could have a some sort of safe room. But yeah, it's a funny industry.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to our thunder round, which is like like a lightning round, but less fast than lightning. I think that was the quickest I've ever managed to describe it.
Yes, good job. Nicely done.
So we were wondering, you've done all this research, you've learned all about burglary, said it correctly that time. What's like the highest level building that you think that you could get into? Like probably not a bank, right? But
no, except for, on the other hand, bank robbery is not actually that difficult. You just have to show a note and you know, they're
more, oh right, yeah, you can get them to give you the money.
Yeah, but whether or not you can get away is the problem.
Super boring.
The highest level, I don't know, I guess I'd say more like what it would be the most unique structure to rob. And so like I love it when the heist genre is applied to an unexpected structure. Like, so there was a movie called The Black Sea, I believe it was, but where Jude Law and a submarine crew actually break into a freaking submarine.
Oh my goodness.
And I think like as a heist film, I think that's a pretty interesting proposition. Like, could you break into a submarine and steal stuff out of it? I think that's a pretty high goal.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Or like a space station or that kind of thing. So I don't know. I love the idea of applying heists to unexpected structures.
Do you think that you personally could do a burglary at just of a house? Not that you would, but you know,
definitely.
If you want, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course. But I also, I feel like a lot of people could do that. You know, it's just a question of just getting into a room and taking something. But yeah, it's when you scale things up, like could you do two apartments in one building at the same time or that kind of thing? I think you get into it slightly
upping
more
the
complicated.
Ante, if you will.
Yeah. Then you got to go through the drywall.
Oh, exactly.
Like that guy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a crazy story too.
Sure.
Can you talk about it in brief?
Do you mean with the guy who...
Who's cutting through drywall kind of from apartment to apartment in a row of townhouses?
Oh yeah, sure. So there was a guy who, man, I can't remember what the police nicknamed him. He was like the something bandit. But he was...
was it the worm in the apple or was that
just a thing? Yeah, it was that guy. But that was the phrase that I used to describe him.
That was your name, Worm.
But he was a man in Cockeysville, Maryland. And he would break into one townhouse and then carve through the drywall into the next and through the drywall into the next and through the drywall into the next. And then he would rob them sort of sequentially. The one detail I really love about it is that when they finally did arrest him, he had a bunch of other people's TV remote controls in the pockets of his sweatpants.
What a weird thing to burgle.
Yeah, it's, you know, the ones, it's like, who are like very just compulsive about it are interesting. It's like, it's almost an end unto itself.
Yeah,
just going in and taking things.
There was another one that I didn't make it into the book, but it was a San Francisco burglar who was trying to get into a house through the automatic garage. And so he stole the automatic garage door opener, but then either the homeowner showed up or the police showed up. But so he ran back out and he hid inside his car and crept down in the back seat so that nobody could see him. But inadvertently, he was resting on the, he was resting on the automatic garage door opener. And so the garage door just kept on opening and closing. And so they just looked around until they found somebody with an automatic garage door opener and they arrested him.
That's kind of an interesting. Are there any other things that didn't make it into the book that you like? Kind of deleted scenes, so we don't spoil the whole thing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of stuff. I got really into art crime. So looking into how people steal paintings from museums and that kind of thing. And there was another retired FBI agent named Thomas McShane who spoke at an event I organized at Columbia a couple of years ago. And emailed with him about some stuff, but the whole world of art crime is really, really fascinating. It's just unfortunately it really rapidly becomes a non-architectural thing. It becomes about how you might fence a painting, or for that matter not, since it's so difficult to sell stolen art, or how you pretend to be a buyer by be dressing undercover and that kind of thing. And so it just really quickly it no longer fit the premise of my book. And so it just seemed like art crime is really fascinating, but it's not really burglary in the sense that I wanted it to be.
And in movies, art crimes are people cutting into glass skylights over the art and then rappelling down. It's like every movie, I feel like every heist movie has a scene like that.
Yeah.
In relation to art crime.
Yeah. I mean, all the best crimes involve rappelling, I think, is the lesson.
Yes, that's the takeaway here.
So your Wikipedia page describes you as a futurist. And I was wondering if that's the first sentence. And I was wondering if I could just list some things, and then you could, I had a way I was going to phrase it, if you could tell me if they're going to happen or not. Because I'm just curious. Shit, okay.
I didn't write that Wikipedia page, I gotta say.
Maybe. That's good, yeah. You shouldn't write your own Wikipedia. Actual hoverboards.
Oh, God, I don't even care, actually. Sorry. Yeah.
No, that's a great response. Right,
Fair enough. Transporters, like where you could transport an object from one place to another.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like on Star Trek, right, where they can just make a copy.
Yeah, they're kind of already doing strange things like that. But yeah, I think certainly we'll see that.
Like meals in pill form.
Oh, yeah.
How fast are you looking at for that?
I mean, arguably, it kind of already exists. Like, if you look into, like, crazy weightlifting subcultures, you can find a lot of already things are becoming so supplement-intensive that real food kind of went away a long time ago.
Fair enough. Mars colony?
I'm on the fence on that. I definitely think it's realistic and possible, but I have a feeling there's going to be a planetary catastrophe here that will wipe out our ability to get to Mars.
All right.
Let's go into that a little more. what's your like best top two guesses for that one?
I definitely, I still think that we are greatly at risk of some sort of plague that is going to hit us and wipe out quite a lot of humans, and then have an economic setback that makes things like space travel, let alone mining and getting access to the resources that we would use for a space program and the fuel and all that kind of stuff, I think would make it really, really, really difficult, as well as an extreme low priority. But then also, I don't know. I'm not optimistic about human beings and their ability to get along. And I think that, incredibly catastrophic war scenarios still make a lot of sense to me in terms of where things might go in the years to come.
That's fair. And then those panic rooms are really going to come in handy.
Exactly.
Yeah. all ties back together.
Yeah.
I'll get another couple more orders.
Grim, but realistic, perhaps. I guess so.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have another one?
The last one is Iron Man suit, which I put as a joke, and now I kind of want to know.
I actually do think that kind of stuff is going to be, I mean, whether or not you can fly with engines or in your palms and in the specific kind of way that he does stuff. But yeah, as far as wearable exoskeletons that might permit flight, I think we're going to see that.
That would be fun. I'm into that one. More than the meal in pill form.
Yeah. Well, also, think about they already have wearable exoskeletons for constructing steamships and that kind of thing. But so you could easily imagine these things being repurposed by a burglar.
Oh yeah.
So if you've got an exoskeleton, imagine just trying to stop somebody from robbing some mansion on Long Island if he's wearing this crazy exoskeleton.
Cool. I think we just pitched the next big thing.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
All right.
Well, thanks so much. This was great.
Cool. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate us 5 stars in the iTunes store.
And leave a shining review.
And remember to subscribe.